Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
In September 1968, a colleague of my father's, working for Bord Fulcher in New York, did me perhaps the greatest favour of my life. He brought me to my first baseball game. I was 10 years old, and a passion was born that autumn evening that has lasted me to this day. I had never experienced anything like the sensory overload that awaited me. The jostling crowds making their way into this New World cathedral. The pungent smells of hot dogs and popcorn being prepared. The dazzling emerald that grew larger in front of us as we emerged from a dark tunnel to gape at the floodlit field stretched out in front of us. And almost immediately, echoing around us, a voice for which the adjective stentorian could have been coined, a voice frequently referred to as the voice of God.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Yankee Stadium.
That voice, the voice of Bob Shepherd, had been a fixture in that place since 1951. His first game had also marked the debut of the great Mickey Mantle and was the final opening day of Joe DiMaggio's career. And for 56 years, until ill health forced him to step aside from the microphone in September 2007, Bob Shepherd's measured tone and meticulous enunciation contributed significantly to the aura and majesty that surrounded the New York Yankees and their big ballpark in the Bronx. He was very clear, however, on the priorities and limitations of his role as a public address announcer, albeit the best-known one in America. A public address announcer, he said, should be clear, concise, correct. He should not be colourful, cute, or comic. His job consisted of welcoming patrons to the ballpark, announcing the starting lineups prior to the game, and as each player came to bat, intoning his name and number. He took great pride in giving equal measure to each name, whether a majestic star or a minor player. He also made it his business to check with visitors or Yankee newcomers if he had the correct pronunciation of their names. He revelled in the ever-expanding melting pot from which the game drew its players, as first Hispanic and then Oriental names were added to his repertoire. He took particular delight in the likes of Salome Barojas and Shigetoshi Hasegawa. On the other hand, he maintained that Anglo-Saxon names are not very euphonious. What can I do with Steve Sachs? What can I do with Mickey Klutz? His visits to the clubhouse to check a pronunciation were legendary. Pitcher Mike Mussina was asked if it was Mussina or Mussina. Stunned, he replied, "Whichever you like." Shepherd retorted, "It's not what I like, young man. It's your name." Though he was fond of pointing out that most men go to work, but I go to a game, nonetheless, part of his routine was his meticulous preparation at the end of every contest, which allowed him, even at an advanced age, to make a speedy exit, thus allowing him to beat the crowds on his way home to Baldwin, New Jersey. For his other life was, if anything, more important to Bob Shepherd. A devoted family man, professor of speech at his alma mater, St. John's University in New York, a devout Catholic who served as lector, not only in his own parish, but also, when the Yankees had a Sunday home game, in a makeshift chapel underneath the stands, where the congregation consisted of ushers, vendors, reporters, and coaches and players from the Yankees and their opponents. He never retired, and cherished the hope that his health would allow him to return, especially when his Yankee Stadium closed at the end of the 2008 season, to be replaced by a lavish, updated replica across the street. Bob recorded the Yankee lineup for the final game at the old place, as well as a message for the fans, which was accorded one of the biggest ovations on an emotional last night. And there was even more emotion in Yankee hearts like mine when news came through on Sunday, July 11th, 2010, that Bob Shepherd had passed away 3 months short of his 100th birthday. Although that was 10 years ago, his voice still opens the broadcast of every Yankee game. In the months and years after 9/11, a feature of all significant Yankee contests was a stirring rendition of God Bless America by the Irish tenor Ronan Tynan. Shepherd, mindful of Tynan's medical qualification in addition to his singing prowess, would always refer in his introduction to Dr. Tynan. Ronan Tynan returned the favor at Bob's funeral by singing On Eagle's Wings and Panis Angelicus. On the day of his father's death, Paul Shepherd said, "If you're lucky enough to go to heaven, you'll be greeted by a voice saying, 'Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to heaven.'"
In honor of the servicemen and women stationed around the globe, Dr. Tynan will now sing God Bless America.
While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free.
We perhaps know Sir Roger Casement best for his daring activities during the run-up to the 1916 Easter Rising. His involvement in 1916 connects with a book we have at home by a German naval captain, Carl Spindler. It's called The Mystery of the Casement Ship and was published in Berlin in 1936. The author has signed the flyleaf with a handwritten dedication and added his motto, "What appears impossible can be made possible. You only have to will it." Spindler had great sympathy for the cause of Irish independence. He met Casement in Germany around the time Casement was persuading the German command to supply arms for the Irish rebels in 1916. It was Spindler who captained the ship named Odd in a circuitous route around the west coast of Ireland to deliver the arms. Casement travelled separately in a submarine and was landed on Banner Strand. He was on a mission to get to the 1916 leaders ahead of the arms delivery to delay the rising, because he had come to believe that the German support was inadequate, as he hadn't been able to get them to provide troops, just arms. He was captured quickly after landing and the Odd was intercepted by the British Navy, but Spindler and his crew donned their German Navy uniforms, disembarked on the ship's lifeboat and scuppered the ship as it was being forced into Cork Harbour. It wasn't the first time that Casement had followed the spirit of Spindler's motto, or tried to, at least. What appears impossible can be made possible. You only have to will it. In the late 19th and early 20th century, the Congo was the personal fiefdom of the Belgian King Leopold II. In 1903, Roger Casement, as a member of the British Foreign Office, investigated the savage treatment and enslavement of the native Congolese people in the extraction of rubber. When his report was published in 1904, it sparked general outrage in the British press and led to the establishment of an international inquiry that confirmed that atrocities were being committed in the Congo. Later on, he also exposed similar brutal treatment of the native people by rubber traders in Putumayo, a remote area in the upper Amazon basin. He was knighted in 1911 by King George V for this investigation. But there was another Irishman involved before Casement in the exposure of savage exploitation in the Congo. Charles Stokes from Dublin, born in 1852, was educated at Portora Royal School in Enniskillen. He had initially travelled to Africa in 1877 as a lay Protestant missionary. After the explorer Henry Morton Stanley wrote to the Daily Telegraph in 1875, espousing the missionary opportunities in Central Africa. Stokes swiftly acclimatized to the life in Africa and married an unbaptized African woman, Limi, the daughter of Chief Mitinyanga of Usongo. He also eventually took on two concubines. Stokes was said to be a genius at organizing and managing caravans of up to 2,000 porters at a time and established a very successful trade in ivory. He mastered the local languages, speaking Swahili with an Irish brogue, it's reported, and built up good relationships with both Arab and Congolese people. He also worked for a time with the Germans, who were scrambling for territory in East Africa in what is now Tanzania. Stokes' downfall came in the Congo in 1895 when he was arrested on charges of trading arms in Belgian territory, summarily sentenced to death and hanged after a perfunctory trial with no due process by a Belgian army officer, Lothair, known by the local people as Bwana Pembe, Mr. Ivory. The illegality of Stokes's trial and execution shocked the British, who claimed him as their own, which he was technically, Ireland being part of Great Britain at that time. It caused a major international incident and led to the British turning their attention to the maltreatment and exploitation going on in the Congo under King Leopold's rule. Ultimately, Stokes's execution led to Casement being commissioned to investigate that exploitation. So it was two Dublin men who were instrumental in bringing down Leopold's personal fiefdom in the Congo and thus striking a major blow against the enslavement of African people. Both these same Dublin men's lives were to be ended by the hangman's noose, Stokes in Africa and Casement in England. Casement, Stokes and Spindler, all interconnected adventurers with their fair share of bravery, all in their own way, following the same search for the possible and willing it to be so.
In fragile light, I hold a small vintage green envelope written in bold letters on the front, telegram, Shagada and Ashka, no charge for delivery. The address in pencil, McGlinchey, Letterkenny. Inside is the telegram, faded with time, Telegrafa en Poste, 1958, via Western Union. Words in ticker tape, Cleveland, Ohio. Baby girl, Sunday morning. Both wonderful. Love to all, Basil. And I picture him at a post office counter in Rocky River. The young immigrant husband, newly turned to father, sending the precise words, baby girl, Sunday morning, both wonderful. This small envelope's eagerly awaited news. I remember my mother once saying the thing that amazed them the most when they arrived in Ohio was lightning bugs, how they would appear on a summer's evening and bring scattered flashes of light. This young couple who believed in the wonder of lightning bugs and a new life and a new country, sending out the message of their daughter's arrival. I've heard it said, when the lightning bug's place gets changed or paved over, they don't move on, they just disappear. Their light dies out. But I believe their magic stays, and I know that their fragile light still flashes through time. All these years later, I still have the telegram, I still hold their wonder of lightning bugs.
I am in the cramped attic with my daughter, searching cardboard boxes for a picture of her as a young child. She needs it for a Zoom quiz with her college friends. I am falling into memories in little paper envelopes. The husband and me before we had babies up along the west of Ireland with gangs of friends. He had hair, and I, though I didn't know it at the time, was almost beautiful. Aoife rummages through the boxes, single-minded. She complains about how many baby pictures there are of her older brothers, how few of her, and marvels at how cute those brothers were as little boys. She's right on all counts. The eldest one brims with mischief in every photo. The younger one is all open smiles. Their little sister, not yet born, where is she? She finds a crumpled paper bag with something soft inside and pulls out a single glove made small for a small hand, knit from blue wool with each finger and thumb in a different bright rainbow colour. What's this doing here? She asks. That's your glove. So why is it here? Well, we have no photos of that day. It was a long time ago, a chilly Saturday in February, and she was very young. We took the train to Dublin, two boys, husband, Aoife and me. We weren't going for fun, to shop or visit the zoo. We went because of Iraq. I told her Britain and America had just announced plans to invade Iraq without UN approval. We'd had a local protest in Limerick, but Dublin was the national one, so we went carrying support from those who couldn't travel. We all hoped there would be a few thousand people there. More than 100,000 showed up. 100,000 people is enormous. And like any anti-war protest, it was eclectic. There were left-leaning politicians with professional banners, Quakers and socialists, veterans of Greenham Common and the CND, singers, anarchists, pacifists and priests, a man who would be president of Ireland one day, and thousands of families. Despite the weather, the atmosphere was buoyant, encouraged as we were by so much support. We thought we were making a difference. We left from Parnell Square in high spirits, moving towards the Dáil. It was very cold. Aoife wore a warm wool hat and, yes, a pair of blue woollen gloves with bright coloured fingers. Somewhere along the first half mile she lost one. The crowd was thick and moving steadily. There was no possibility of going back. I took her cold hand in mine and we kept walking. She wasn't very happy, but as always, she refused to cry, refused to be carried, refused to be the baby. Aoife, I should explain, was gifted at that stage of her life with a kind of magnetic, sulky strength. When faced with any kind of struggle, she would adopt a spectacular pout that broadcast her discontent in a way best described as charismatic, while somehow building her up on the inside. Annoyingly for her, such melodrama on her little face was both incongruous and sweet. She drew a lot of smiles from the people around us, and this only made her worse. There was nothing we could do. By now, the missing glove had surely been trampled on the cold, wet street. And then the impossible happened. As the protest snaked around the city, the long march looped back on itself, so soon we were meeting and passing the tail end of the protest, the people who had started far behind us. We were all waving and chatting, and suddenly there it was, secured to the top of a homemade placard. One small blue glove with rainbow fingers. I reached for it, and the young man holding the sign saw its match on Aoife's free hand. He knelt down to ceremonially present it to her. Was I delighted? She asks. Well, I was, and he was, but no, you weren't. Why? I think you thought he had stolen it. We have no photographs of the day. We don't have enough photographs of Aoife as a wee thing. But that tattered glove brings it back more vividly than any picture. Her cold hand, her stubborn frown, the smiles of strangers, her determination to march with her brothers and not be carried, her refusal to complain, to be pacified or patronised, the cold wind, the hope we held and shared, the fearless girl she always was. The glove won't work for her, as a baby picture for a Zoom quiz with friends. But as a memory keeper, it certainly works for me.
Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River.
For me, my brother, and my friends, when we let our imaginations loose, it was always our sporting daydreams that featured most prominently. We tried anything and everything and went wherever the sporting mood took us. Or more accurately, we aped the superstars we were seeing on television. The dreams changed weekly, monthly and yearly. At different four-year cycles, it was the World Cup or the Olympics. When we could kick ball like Johan Cruyff or run laps like Lasse Virren. Even if the reality was very different. Every September we were hurlers and footballers, kicking or pucking the winning scores in the All-Ireland with the cheers in our ears. In April, footballs were kicked to touch. Hurleys were downed and golf clubs were picked up and we were storming Augusta National like the young matador Seve Ballesteros en route to winning the Masters. But no sooner was that over than cues replaced clubs and we were tearing around the snooker table like Alex Higgins and potting balls for fun. Meanwhile, those of us who had the piped television, as everyone in Dublin called having the BBC and UTV, never let a winter pass without plaguing our parents to bring us to the artificial ski slope in Kiltearnan. The Dublin mountains were higher than the Alps, as far as we were concerned, when there was no such thing as a skiing holiday. After watching Ski Sunday, we knew, given a chance, we could be the next Franz Klammer or Alberto Tomba. We were convinced. This was the life. That we were right to dream was brought home to me from mid-March onwards. All those days and nights, weeks and months of no sport, when all we had was our dreams. It might be to kick back the march of time and have a 2020 vision to kick ball in a Junior B game one last time. Or maybe just to dream of what we're missing and the way our imaginations allowed us conquer the world. The past few weeks should have been Wimbledon's. Those weeks where a strange kind of glory comes over all of us. We're not really a tennis nation and never have been. But even if you don't know a tennis racket from a squash racket, it doesn't matter when it comes to Wimbledon. It sucks you in, seduces you, has you craving strawberries and cream. 40 years ago this week, myself and my brother were Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe. We were in Dingle at the start of our summer holidays and we were playing out our dreams. Borg, brooding and beautiful looking, with the flowing blonde locks that seemed more a homage to the Summer of Love or Woodstock than 1980s coiffure. McEnroe, the brash young New Yorker, and as much a raging bull as boxer Jake LaMotta ever was. Both wearing headbands. We wanted those bands badly. But with no Amazon or eBay back in 1980, we improvised with our elasticated nylon football socks. With our rackets in hand, we set off to our centre court, a couple of miles east of Dingle to Dúnshíon Strand. Ours was the first Wimbledon final that depended totally on tidal conditions. It had to be out long enough for the sand to be compacted and hard. Rain was never going to stop play, but soft sand could. Then we mapped out our court with the precision of a cartographer charting territory. We'd no nets, we'd no wigs either to complete our carbon copy looks. But we did have an umpire, my first cousin from up the road, who called us to arms like we were going to war. And we were. Across a little inlet on Kennard was where Patriot Thomas Ashe used to play his pipes. They were the war pipes to us, so we were in the right place. Borg won the real final in five sets. Ours never got that far, because in acting out the part of McEnroe to perfection, my brother fired more expletives than aces and disputed so many line calls that the umpire was soon swimming off in the direction of the headland where Ash played his pipes. We didn't mind, though. That youth was ours, and we were playing out our dreams, just like our contemporaries on beaches and in gardens up and down the country were. Like they might be this week, as a reminder of what we're missing and what we want back. Want back badly.
I finally saw him. The elderly man with the beige cargo shorts walked past me the other day. He was wearing a mask, of course, but I still knew it was him. Whether it's the middle of a freezing winter or the stifling humidity of New York summer, he always wears the same shorts with white knee socks. I used to spot him having morning coffee with his wife, him reading the FT, her reading the New York Post. They live in a doorman building close to my brownstone. We never speak, but I like seeing them. I find it reassuring. I once texted a photo of them to a friend with the hashtag relationship goals. I usually talk to people in the neighborhood. Last year, I sat next to a lady on a bench and we struck up a conversation. "I'm Winnie," she said. "Quentin, nice to meet you," I replied. She was wearing a straw trilby and ate lunch out of the pocket in her walker. Winnie grew up five doors from where I live now. We talked about the high cost of living in New York. Winnie didn't think that she would have to deal with it for long. "I moved back here when I was 95," she said. "I'm now 101. She came here to die," she told me. Her mother owned a brownstone here, but lost it over 70 years ago in the Great Depression. She points it out. It's still there. She recalled one of her mother's tenants sitting on her luggage on the sidewalk in a full-length raccoon coat. She couldn't pay her rent. With rumblings these days of another Great Recession or worse, depression, I sometimes think of that woman in her raccoon coat, wondering where on earth she'll go next. In normal times, people walk the streets of New York. I can usually sit on my stoop on summer evenings and watch the world go by. But during the lockdown, Manhattan's streets have been more like those in Los Angeles, mostly empty, like a toy town. I've missed Donna, an Israeli woman in her 60s with copper hair and blue eyeshadow, who works in the laundrette at the top of my street. My Saturday morning routine involves me dropping off my laundry and helping myself to a cup of coffee which she brews for customers by the door. And I often chat with her colleague Charles, an elderly African-American gentleman who grew up in New York. He's usually holding court alongside Donna. I love catching up on the local news with him. He's one of the most popular personalities on the street. Donna is both realistic and optimistic. She fought in the Israeli army and 30 years ago survived a suicide bomb attack in Tel Aviv. She was caught in the blast while taking money out of an ATM. The glass window of the bank shattered, she told me, and she spent months recovering in hospital. The laundrette has finally reopened for just a few days a week. The other day, wearing my mask, I dropped my laundry bag onto the scales and waved at Donna, from 6 feet away. "I came to New York for a better life," she told me. "I thought I'd be safe here, and now this?" We laughed darkly at the poetic injustice. The people on the street where I live are familiar strangers. I've grown accustomed to their faces and their routines. The guy who slowly walks his elderly Labrador every morning with a leash attached to a giant keychain on his belt. They are lifelong companions, it seems, partners and also friends. Usually our street is quite normal, whatever that means in New York. With 8 million people living on top of each other, moving here is not a decision taken lightly. We are used to preserving our personal space, but social distancing, not so much. Last week I met Anwar, our local dog walker in the park. He's less busy these days, of course, and we stopped to chat. It was nice to check in with him face to face, without the need for Google Hangouts, FaceTime, or Zoom. Anwar emigrated to the US from Egypt roughly the same time as I moved from Ireland. He fell in love with the mother of one of his dog walking clients. His new bride is from Staten Island. A year ago, I went to a party to celebrate his 5-year anniversary in the US. Donna and Charles from the Laundrette were there too. In fact, Donna's the one who set them up. I recently told her she's like the matchmaker from Fiddler on the Roof. She's matchmade quite a few of her customers over the years. Egyptian Muslims, Israeli Jews, and New Yorkers of all stripes were at that party. We are a mixed bunch of first-generation immigrants from all over the world. This is the New York I know and love. That night, we talked and ate food, laughed, and listened to speeches full of gratitude. I looked around the room and everyone was somehow connected. That sometimes happens with familiar strangers. Sooner or later, they are all so familiar that when you're not looking, they become friends.
On this morning's programme, we heard Bob Shepherd, Voice of the Yankees by Jonathan White. Casement, Spindler and Stokes was by Frank Kavanagh. In Fragile Light, a poem by Denise Blake. Aoife's Glove was by Sheila Killian. Game, Set and Match was by Joe O'Mara-Herthig. And Familiar Strangers by Quentin Fottrell. The music today, God Bless America, sung by Ronan Tynan and introduced by Bob Shepherd. Ok, Regrette Ingai Mama by Franco Luambo and Tipe Ok Jazz. Chopin's Prelude No. 23 in F Major, played by Grigory Sokolov. Eve of Destruction was by Barry Maguire. And finally, Heyday by Mick Christopher. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.